Okay, well, page 32, 33. And I left you last time with something to think about, that the Babylonian Talmud says, Toshma, come in here, this own Talmud, and the Zohar brothers say, come and see. Tohavi, Tohami. And the Haggadah says, Tzei Lamad, go out and learn. Now, one way to explain it is this. We're talking about appreciating Torah. Torah Shema is when someone's going to give an explanation of a Torah idea. Say, Tochamim, Tochavim. Say, Ulmad also is a question of understanding a Torah idea. Now, one element, and maybe you could generalize this to the whole, but at least one element in Torah understanding is to see the world in the light of the Torah. To read the Torah as a way of viewing the world and understanding it. Question then is, how far can we do that? To what depth can we do it? To what extent can we do it? How widely can we apply the Torah to understanding the world? And the thought here is that that depends upon our condition and the world's condition. The Torah will penetrate just so far. And the better its conditions, it will penetrate even further, and the worse conditions, it will penetrate less. The world becomes more opaque or more transparent, covering God's presence more or revealing God's presence more. It's going to vary from time to time. In Babylonia, the invitation to apply a Torah thought was Torah Shema, come and see. Did I come and hear? You can hear even when it's dark. Verbal communication works even when there's no light. And it's not an accident. The verse says, "B'machshakim hoshivani Hashem," God placed me in the dark. And God Chazal says that is Torah Shema. So you have a connection. The verse says you are placed in the dark, and that's Golos Bavel. And the invitation to appreciate Torah idea in Bavel is Torah Shema. Come and hear. But hearing is what you can do when it's dark and you can't see. That means that in the Jerusalem Talmud and in the Zohar, when it says to come and see, that's because it's light. That means that the Torah penetrates to a much greater depth. When it's dark, you don't even see the one from whom the speech is coming. Your contact is indirect. You hear the speech, whereas when you see him. Seeing is related to him. Speech is something he produces. Speech is like a very fast letter. Comes instantaneously, but what you're hearing is sound. If you push it even further, at Sinai it says, the people saw the voices. That's an astonishing penetration. Here's something which you can't see at all. In normal life, light does not penetrate to voices. The light doesn't affect voices. Voices can only be heard. They got to a position where the light penetrated so far, as Chazal commented, growing this initially. They saw that which is heard. They had a direct perception of that which is only indirect. They had the light, which usually only had in the dark. So, the difference in phraseology between the Bavli on the one hand, the Yerushalmi and Zohar on the other hand, reflects the extent to which they're in the light, the extent to which the Torah penetrates and illuminates the world around us. That's that section. Now we're not going to say Seilmat. Seilmat means that you have to abandon your natural assumptions, your natural understanding, and see things in a new light. See things in a light which is not natural to you. That's because you're short-sighted, because you're limited. And you have to break those patterns of understanding to try to appreciate the truth. Now, let's take three examples. Jacob spent 20 years in the house of Laban. Laban tried to cheat him, tried to trick him. Laban wasn't a nice fellow. He was a nasty fellow. In Egypt, the Egyptians enslaved the Jews, forced them into horrible labor. At one point, made a decree to drown all the newborn male children. That's incident number two. Then you have Haman and the Holocaust, where the attempt was to wipe out every man, woman, and child. That's one of the children. To murder every man, woman, and child. Haman tried, and in the Second World War, they succeeded in wiping out 1/3 of the Jewish population. Now, if you would rate those threats in terms of severity, my guess is everybody's intuition, everybody hasn't been primed by the fact that I'm asking the question, everybody's intuition would say that Haman and the Holocaust is the annihilation of Jewish people. There's nothing worse than that. Pharaoh was trying to break us, minimize our reproduction, break our spirit, to the extent of murdering the newborn male babies. Laban wasn't a nice guy, you know, he tried to cheat us in various ways, but couldn't compare with Egypt, and certainly couldn't compare with Haman and the Holocaust. The Haggadah wants us to understand that that's not correct. That's not correct. That's a wrong expression, wrong understanding. But look what it says on 32, 33. Say Oman. Go out and learn what Laban the Aramean attempted to do to our father Jacob. For Pharaoh decreed only against the males. Laban attempted to uproot everything. Pharaoh's decree to murder newborn male Jewish babies was not nearly as bad as Laban's plan. Laban's was far worse. Indeed, some commentators say that the reason why we left Laban and end up in Egypt. After all, when God told Abraham that he was going to spend 400 years in exile, he didn't say where. The verse doesn't give you a clue where this is supposed to be. And it could just as well have been by Laban. But the challenge with Laban was too great. We would have been lost. We would not have been able to withstand it. So he sent us to Egypt instead because it was an easier challenge. Indeed, read the verse that the Haggadah cites. As it is said, an Aramean attempted to destroy my father, and he descended to Egypt to sojourn. The verse is juxtaposing these two ideas. Laban, the Aramean, tried to destroy my father, and my father went to Egypt. I mean, it's not just A and B. The Torah is never written that way. If it juxtaposes, it means that one is the reason for the other. The love of the Aramean tried to destroy my father, and because of that he went to Egypt, because had he had to face Laban for 400 years, there would have been nothing left. Now, when you look in the verses that describe Lavan, Lavan's behavior, Lavan's statements, it's not exactly obvious that that's what he wanted. Okay, if you read them carefully, you could see it. My point now is not that whether you could see it in the verses. My point is, so that's what he wanted. So what? He wasn't threatening to murder anybody. He was threatening cultural assimilation. You know, Jacob, you have crazy ideas, but you're living in my country. You're living in my culture. You have your crazy ideas. Your crazy ideas will die with you, and your children and grandchildren and grandchildren will belong to me. They'll all belong to me. They'll fade out because your ideas are crazy. How seriously should we take a threat like that? I think our natural feeling is, as long as they're going to leave me alone, as long as they're not going to murder me, as long as they let me have my yeshivas, it's okay. They want to put some curriculum in my yeshivas, you know, okay, so they'll learn biology in the daytime, and nighttime will tell them it's not true. And we'll get around it. We'll manage it, you know. They'll study a Jewish history course in university, and they'll tell them that, like I studied before I was from, that the Hebrew God is the God of vengeance, who thunders from the heavens. The so-called professor didn't even open the book to read it. That's all right. You don't have to read books to be a professor. You can just say things that are popular and get away with it. You know, I have no thought of accuracy, but that's what you'll hear. That's what you'll read. I had a boy when I was an undergraduate. The boy came from Flatbush Yeshiva in Brooklyn, which is already a symptom of his weakness. And he took a biblical Hebrew course, and professor said in the first lecture that Hebrew is the most corrupt of all Semitic languages. By the end of the semester, his yarmulke was gone, and he was eating trays. And I corrupt is a technical term in linguistics. It doesn't mean bad or nasty or vicious or criminal. Right? Corrupt means that it's the most changed from the root of that family of language, which isn't true either. Right? But he was lost. He was just lost. So, our natural intuition is to downplay this kind of threat, cultural threat, or religious threat. And I got to say, you've got to go out of that mindset. Look, God took them down to Egypt to avoid the threat of Lavan. Lavan's threat was certainly worse than that of Egypt. I would think of the terrible suffering, 85 or 90 years of slavery in Egypt. And nothing to compare with the threat that of Lavan. And even in Egypt, within the 210 years, the vast majority of Jews were culturally almost lost. Lavan was much stronger threat. Anyway, that's I think on the surface anyway what the Rambam means when it says.
The Jews almost lost in Egypt. They were Egyptians.
The Chazal say that there are 50 gates of defilement altogether. They had already passed through 49. 49 out of 50. That's pretty far gone.
Are we better than them?
And I said last time, you weren't here, I guess. I said last time that God calculated the end, and there were three ways to read the Pasuk for the 400 years, and he made it the shortest period of time, because had he waited any longer, there wouldn't have been anything left to say. Right? And are we better? That's another question. It's not relevant to the Haggadah. Anyway. So that's the first thing that the Haggadah says. And the verse says, it went down with a few people and became a nation great, mighty, and numerous. Now, I want you to understand what's going on in this section of the Haggadah. In the heavy print, the boldface font, you have quotations from the book of Deuteronomy. And the light font is explanations, almost all of them quoted from the book of Exodus. Now, we should understand what's going on here. We're talking about the story of the Exodus. There's a whole book called Exodus. Why wouldn't you take the story from the book of Exodus? And why are you going to do it? Take a verse from there and explain it from over here, back and forth. Okay, it's true. Jews like to make things complicated, because reality is usually complicated. But there's got to be some particular reason here. Now, if you look up the verses from Deuteronomy, you will see that they are in the section of first fruits, Bikurim. The farmer comes up from his field and brings his first fruits to Jerusalem, and he makes a declaration to the Kohen, and this is the declaration that he makes. I think, again, as I've told you many times, it's only on the surface, I'm not talking the depths. Who's reciting the Haggadah? What kind of person is he? Where is he from? What is his life like? So, for hundreds of years, these were Jewish residents of the land of Israel, with their own economy, their own army. For 400 years, they had their own king, which we had in plus years before that. They had a kind of federation of tribes. Almost 800 years. A nation that exists in its land and is reasonably independent for 800 years is quite a remarkable thing. In history, it's not common at all. Who's coming up to the temple? This Jew who says that the exodus from Egypt is history. That's not where I'm sitting. I'm a successful farmer in Jaffa. I'm a successful farmer in the Panhandle. Panhandle has 3 crops a year, one of the richest soils on the face of the planet. So the Haggadah meets him. The Haggadah says, yes, we know where you're coming from. You're coming from a settled, secure, peaceful circumstance, and you are recalling the past. We'll see that recalling is not quite right. It's not quite strong enough when we get there, but that's the position that we're taking at this point in Haggadah. So that's why you have verses from Deuteronomy that talk about Bikurim, first fruits, and then they're explained on the basis of the Sukkim from Shmos, from Exodus, yeah.
I was thinking, man, when you said, I was thinking about why you said Selamah instead of Tashmar. Come, when I think of come, I think of it as a more of a passive verb that you're saying, come to me. And because we were talking about before that the mitzvah is not to just tell the story, but to experience it. So when I hear the word come, like come to me, he came to me, or come to me is more passive, while go out is more of an active verb. That makes me think that, oh, go out and experience it, while come is like, come to me, we can talk about it, but when I hear go out, I feel like that verb makes me think to experience it more than just to tell it over.
Interesting. I mean, they're both active verbs. Well, they'll tell you to do something, but they'll tell you to move, in fact.
Right.
You're thinking maybe that if I say come, it means we're going to do it together, whereas
right.
I say go out, it's like you can do it on your own. Interesting. I'll think about it. Interesting observation. Okay? Interesting observation. Okay, now, let me acquaint you with a fact which may be useful to you. They went to the town with a few people and became a great nation. A nation great, mighty, and numerous. How many people went down to Egypt?
70.
And when they left, how many were there?
3 million.
Okay. Something like 3 million. Let's say, for the sake of the numbers, I'm going to give you 2.5 million.
Minus 12 million, is that?
Oh, so now let's say 80% died in the 3 days of darkness. So if 80% died and 2.5 million went out, a little math now, how many were there before the 3 days of darkness? 12.5 million. Is it reasonable? Is it reasonable to go from 70 to 2.5 billion in 210 years, let alone 12.5 million. Okay, those who are shaking their heads are shaking their heads because they've never tried it. But if you sit down with a little calculator, you can do this on your watch, well, my watch anyway, you just get yourself a little calculator, and you will discover the following. There's 70 people, actually it's 140, but leave that out for now, because I mean, that counts the wives. Correct, it's really 140, but leave that out for now. Suppose you start with 70. 210 years is 7 generations. Because when you reproduce, usually reproduce, women reproduce, all reproduction depends on women, right? The men are grossly irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
Only women can have children. Mm-hmm. That's why when Jacob sent the bride to his brother, he sent 10% males and 90% females. That's how you increase your flock. That was more males, with more females. Okay, back to work. So now, let's say it's 70. I don't mind. I need 140. Let's suppose you have 7 generations, because a generation is 30 years. A woman gets roughly between the ages of 20 and 40. How many children, on the average, must a person leave behind to go from 70 to 2.5 million in 7 generations? The answer is 4.6. That's all. Raise 4.6 to the 7th power and multiply it times 70 and you will get 2.5 million. But what about 12.5 million? All you need is 5.6. You see, those exponents are terrific. You know, when you raise it to the 7th power, you know, a little difference here makes a gigantic difference at the end. Try it. I did it decades ago when all I had was a calculator, you know. I didn't have a program or a computer where you could solve an equation. And that's what it turns out to be. So it is not the spectacularly, extravagantly impossible figure that you think. Okay, it's true if the average is, let's say, 5.6, so that means that per couple it's 11 children is a lot, especially in ancient times, you have different mortality and all the rest. But you don't need some extravagant nace. I mean, today we have the families of 14, 15, 16, 18 kids. We have, I know such people. And, it's on the large side of the spectrum. You don't need, in particular, there's a midrash that says they gave birth to 6 at a time. You don't need that midrash to justify the numbers. The midrash may very well be true, unless it's not taken literally by the commentators. But you don't need it. The midrash is not coming to solve a numerical problem. Because without that, the numbers aren't the difficulty. And by the way, when I did this calculation, I cheated a little bit in the wrong side, because I ended up with 12.5 million for the last generation alone. But the previous generation didn't entirely disappear, and what went out were two or perhaps part of three generations. Right? People don't die that fast. Two of them die at the age of 40. Right? So really, I'm figuring low. Okay? So when 30 became numerous in that way, you don't need to imagine a spectacular open miracle. Yeah?
Well, I was going to say, if you're slaves, though, old slaves generally have less reproduction rates, like you're slaves.
Okay, now, you have to know when that took place. Of course, it took place. The commentators say there were about 85 or 90 years of slavery. Right, so the first all the time that Joseph and his whole generation lived, there was no slavery. I think it's the Gros says it's about 85 or 90 years of slavery. Now, of course, that's the last two or three generations, and that's where the most of the increase is going to take place. But still, you don't have to you don't have to see a visible miracle that that's the women are giving birth to 20 children and at a shot, and it's just not necessary. Yeah.
Doesn't it appear that the population boom was before the actual slavery? At the time, that's why Pharaoh made all the laws against the boys.
If you
so that really
if you would if,
now, right?
Well, you are right that there was some significant population increase because that was the motivation. But it also says, "Vayikasher." Thank you for us. Pasuk says, "The more they oppressed them, the more they increased." Right. Thank you for us. Thank you for us. The Chasher Yanu also, as they oppressed them, Ken Yirve the Ken Yifros. So as they oppressed them, they increased even more. I'm just saying you said there must have been a population increase beforehand to justify its power. I agree, but the verse then says that in spite of the affliction, they increased even more. Now, if you want to call it a miracle in his sense, these are oppressed people, they shouldn't have any babies at all. They should be in shock, or they should be exhausted all the time. Maybe, but it's not the miracle, it's not the extravagant increase in numbers that everybody thinks. Every woman must have had hundreds of children, and it would have been, a visible, obvious, grand, unheard of miracle. You don't need that for the numbers. The numbers don't require it.
Were any babies killed?
So it's an interesting question. It doesn't appear that anybody really. You must have two things. First of all, he told the midwives to kill them secretly. Mm-hmm. None that died then. They refused to obey the command. Then he commanded his people that they should all be killed.
But he made an announcement to all the Egyptians, go and take the babies and kill them.
That's right. And that's why when Moses was born, he was born 6 months early. She had him only for 3 months because they kept track of pregnant women and they tracked when they gave birth.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But remember, remember what I said before? What did I say before? That's an unfair test.
Yeah.
That the only thing that reproduction depends upon is
females.
This is a proof, by the way. This is a proof of what Chazal say. When they say, why were they killing the males? Why did they suddenly decide to kill all the males?
Wasn't the prophecy that a male would come up?
That there would be a savior for the Jewish people. They had in their magic, they had a prediction that the Savior was going to be born. So they tried to kill him. You can't say that this was an attempt to limit the Jewish population, because killing male babies will not limit the population at all. It won't have any effect on the population. The only way to affect the population is to attack the female. So people don't stop to think. If you think about that, you see the Chazal have to be right. It can't be for the point of putting pressure on the population. Those days especially, they could have more than one wife, so every woman could be giving birth, even if you killed males.
Okay. Were babies killed?
Yes, I assume they were. Right? That's how. Anyway, it doesn't say, but I assume that's true.
Wasn't there a nutrition model like a baby that was put into a brick or something? So some babies have to be killed.
Yeah, in fact, you're right. We mentioned that Ramban says one of the reasons that the Egyptians could be punished for what they did is because they feed them and killing the babies. Which that was not part of the prediction that God gave Abraham. Good, okay. This is all very interesting. I'm going to have to come to some more ground. Fine. Now the Haggadah will take apart the verse from Deuteronomy, phrase by phrase. He went down to Egypt, compelled by the divine decree. In other words, he didn't go down voluntarily. There was a famine, and Joseph was already second in command, and it was a place to be able to support his family, and he went down, he tried to set it up in such a way that it would only be temporary. That's next Vayagar. Lagur means to dwell temporarily. That's why Ger was called a Ger Toshav. It's just a fellow traveler, someone there superficially. This teaches that our father Jacob did not send into to settle, but only to sojourn temporarily, as it says. When the five of the sons of Jacob were brought to Pharaoh, and Pharaoh said, what do you do? And they said, we have come to sojourn in this land because there's no pasture for the flocks of your servants, for the famine is severe in the land of Canaan. It's a famine, and we have flocks, and we can't support our flocks in the land of Canaan. But the implication would have been that if the famine reverses and the pasture lands restored, we'll go back home. We're not here to stay. Please let the servants stay in the land of Goshen. The few people, as it is written, 70 persons, your forefathers ascended to Egypt, now Hashem your God has made you as numerous as the stars of the heaven.
12.5 million people, I mean, it's a lot, but it's not, in terms of nations, it's not that many people. You know, we always talk about numerous, so very numerous, but 12.5 million people is not that big. It's not a big nation at all.
Well, first of all, you're talking about 12.5 million in ancient times.
Right.
So the world population
is less.
Much less. I think, now what did I say? I saw it from the almanac. World population until about 300, 400 years ago was about constant, and then it went up very gradually until recently it went up like this. What was the world population? I think it was 500 million or something. The world population at the constant.
It's like 6 billion.
6.5 billion, yeah. If you wait till tomorrow, it'll be bigger. I want you to know, it is estimated that with the naked eye in a non-polluted area, you can see something between 10 and 30,000 stars. So if you're talking about like the stars of the heavens, so then it's in the right ballpark. Okay? Now, became a nation. That means we had our own separate identity. This teaches the Israelites were distinctive there. And we're going to be very careful about this. We were a separate identity, but that separate identity was very greatly compromised. Where did I bring this one? Second. On page 37, right in the middle of the page, you see the quotation of Deuteronomy 4:34. Has God ever attempted to take unto himself a nation from the midst of another nation? Goy mikerev goy. A nation from the midst of another nation. Chazal's picture here is very extreme. Chazal says it like an ubar, a fetus in the womb of its mother. A fetus in the womb of its mother, which gets all of its nourishment from the mother, which has no contact with the outside world. It's completely surrounded by the mother. Now, is the fetus a separate identity? Yes. This is a separate identity. I mean, let's make it drastic, right? Imagine that the fetus is male. Okay? The mother's female, and the fetus is male. Definitely a separate identity. But it can't function separately. It has the potentiality of becoming an independent adult, but in its present condition, it can't function as independent. So we became mitsuyonim sham, distinct. We became a goy. But we were goy bekerev goy. A nation, it's the same word goy, right? We became a nation, but a nation within another nation, like a fetus in the womb. That's an indication of what we spoke about before, the fact that they lost their identity, that they became assimilated into the Egyptian life.
But this was a step up, though, from when they were.
From where? From when? From,
well,
from the land of Israel under Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob?
No.
Definitely not.
I guess 50 years before, 100 years before. Why when they... Like after, I guess, when they went through all the gates. But when did this happen?
Oh, so I think you have to picture it this way. While the brothers of Joseph were alive, he was the first to die.
Joseph?
Yeah. While the brothers were alive, of course they were distinct. They were Jacob's children, you know, this upper class, who were the family of the second in command in Egypt. They were definitely distinct, but they weren't a nation. They weren't a god. They were a family. Right? Family of who knows how many hundreds of people. That's a clan. Now they began to increase in population to the point where you could call them a god. You could call them a nation. Then, as they increased to become a goy, they also lost their grip on their distinctiveness to the point where the Medrash could say that they were idol worshippers, right? So now the Haggadah is telling us a bit of a surprise. Still, they were mitsuyan. Don't think they were indistinguishable from the Egyptians. They were distinguished. They were a goy. There was enough in them to make them a goy. But not what they should have been. Not, you know, at this point they were passing through the 49 gates of the Pilate, becoming more and more polluted by the Egyptian milieu, but they were still a goy.
Doesn't it say somewhere that we held on to like three things?
Yes. The Medrash says, and there's different versions of the Medrash, different texts of the Medrash. Our names, our language,
clothing
is There is really such a chazal. It's hard to find, but there is such a chazal. There's another one which the other text says, which I forget already. But if you understand, this is the banner of success, right? Names, language, clothing. That's it. Yeah, you can tell a Jew. He's the one who eats gefilte fish. Right? You know, when you go into the store, you have the kosher section of the store. You know, gefilte fish over there. You don't have gefilte fish in the trade section. Nobody eats gefilte fish but us, right? Yeah. So you imagine someone from Ukraine coming to America. How can I tell, you know, who the Jews are, where they are? Watch people who buy gefilte fish. Go to the Jews. That's not a great claim to our national distinctiveness, you know, the fact that we're still buying gefilte fish. Yeah.
How do you define identity in nation?
I think you have to define it klapichut, socially. You know, if we are regarded as a distinct group, so then... And that would make us distinct in that sense. If we aren't regarded as a distinct group.
So in the eyes of Israel, like in relation.
I think that's right. Yeah.
So the whole zikhut of the Jews was on some nationalistic, their nationalistic characteristics, such as language. Because as a Jew is far more than that.
Correct. That's the tragedy.
The uniqueness of a Jew is that it's we're not a nation as your race.
100%. They lost it. That's why the Levites were not involved. The Levites were not enslaved. Right? The Levites did.
What was the zechut of?
They didn't have. I'm surprised at you. They didn't have zechut. It was taken out even without zechut. They didn't have zechut. It's not dependent upon zechut.
I'm just a bit confused. Just one thing to clarify. The very reason we became a Jewish nation was that we accept. Okay, there was a promise to Abraham, but we accepted the yoke of the Torah.
That was 46 days after they left. Sure, 46 days after they left.
So at that moment, what was the...
46 days later? Who's talking about that? I'm talking about them in Egypt.
They didn't name it food. God just kicked them out.
No, but God, why did God choose us as their nation?
So it says, Moses asked this question of God, and God said to him, they will serve me on this mountain when I take them out. There's nothing in them now that merits it. It's for the sake of the future, not because of what they've already done.
So from when does God work like this?
Okay, you're coming in. You haven't heard all the shirim that I've been giving after the past 3 months. I can't do it all now. But well, you're right to make the observation. But this is the beginning. This is the starting point. Yeah. This is our ABCs. Right? The Rebbe took us out only because he promised the patriarchs and because we will be able to serve him, but not because of anything we deserved in between. Yeah.
Well, does the VM included in the numbers when they say that the 12.5 million of the...
Yes. Here they are included.
So, I mean, you can assume that since they weren't enslaved, that they were obviously producing at a normal rate anyway, and they say, hey, our brothers are being, you know, tortured even more, let's have more children. I mean...
No. Does anybody know the answer to this? The answer is that the lady was the smallest of the tribes. Recalculate. Lady was the smallest of the tribes.
Why weren't they enslaved at all? I mean...
Okay, so I'll just tell you. But then, at the end of the result, you have to recalculate your thoughts. They were the smallest of the tribes, and they weren't this way. The way in which Midrash says, how did they instigate the slavery? Just come to the people who were the family of the second in command, because the second man died, but still, and say to them, from now on, you're slaves. So what they did was they had a day of national voluntary labor. And everybody joined in. Everybody joined it, and then they continued it gradually, letting off others and keeping the Jews in. That's the way it was done. And those Jews who felt a kind of need to express their loyalty and gratitude to the Egyptian nation, which houses them and is so faithful to them and so kind to them, they started off this voluntary labor. And the Levites said, "Alone, we're not taking part in this. Forget it." And they wanted it to be quasi-legal. Even the Nazis passed laws. They passed laws and then followed them. They didn't just murder Jews on sight. No, they passed laws and they used the laws to murder Jews. So here Egyptians also said, you know, we're a legal society. We do things according to laws. The laws are structured this and this way. The Levites never bought it, so they couldn't get it. Right? If you got more than 90%, it's good enough. Okay, back to work. Great and mighty. So the rivers were fruitful, increased greatly, multiplied, became very, very mighty. The land was filled with them. Now, Rav doesn't really mean numerous. Rav is one of these terms which means sort of big. Numerous means something you count. Big can be something you count, big class, which means there are a lot of members in the class. Or it could be a big mountain, where it's not something you count, not a lot of units.
But to 37?
Yeah, 33. Here, the Haggadah quotes a verse from Ezekiel, which uses a version of Rav, which has nothing to do with numerous, and really nothing to do with big. It has to do with mature, developed. As it says, I made you. Now here, Rivava Ketsemech HaSodeh, like the grass of the field. Rivava is just a poetic way of saying Rav. Rav means big. When you think of grass, do you think of individual blades of grass? You have a lot of grass. You must have at least 2 million blades. Oh no, it's 3.5 million blades. Cram again. Look how close they are together. Lots and lots of blades of grass. Right? Or do you think of the area that's covered by grass? I have 6 acres of grass. 6 acres. Not counting the individual blades, counting the area that it covers. Right? So again, I'm not convinced that Rivava here means lots and lots of blades of grass. It means I made you big, like a large area that's covered, and the plants of the field, and you grew and developed, became charming, beautiful of figure, your hair grown long, but you were naked and bare, and I passed over you, and I saw you downtrodden in your blood. And I said, through your blood shall you live, through your blood shall you live. This is an unbelievable vision. You're talking about the development of a young woman. She reaches maturity. Beautiful. Charming. Beautiful. Naked and bare. Wallowing in her blood. And he tells her, the Navi tells her, to your blood you shall live.
Is that like referencing Nida?
So it's a little hard. First of all, a woman doesn't wallow in the blood of Nida.
But then maturing and then through your blood you will live.
I understand. Second of all, is he telling her the facts of biology that every woman knows and everyone has known since the beginning of time? You know, why make a big deal out of it? And why would the Chesed of the prophet write about it? Furthermore, in context, this young woman that he's describing is developed as a Jewish people. Otherwise, what's the point of talking about it altogether? Who is this young woman? What are we talking about? And the book of Ezekiel is not a text in feminine sexual development. Now, the picture here is the Jewish people in Egypt who grew and developed but had no mitzvahs. That's what it means to be naked. Naked and bare. You have to explain the two
what
words.
Mean they were beautiful.
They had an inner character, which came from the patriarchs, and the fact that they were assimilated into the Egyptian surroundings was to a large extent was a superficial external cover. Now, the blood that's referred to here is the blood of the Korban Pesach and Bris Milah. God performed 9 plagues. After the 9 plagues, he said, look, my plan is that you should leave. Right? But you have to do something. Okay, I had 9 plagues. You didn't do anything to deserve it. You had no schut. So I did it to you. But you have to do something. You're not getting out for nothing. You at least have to show that you pledge allegiance. And I'm giving you two mitzvos, circumcision and the Korban Pesach, Paschal sacrifice. And that blood, those bloods, and that's why some commentators say it's repeated. I said to you, you show your blood shall live. I don't believe the verse in Yecheskel, it only says it once. The Haggadah says it twice. Even though Mar Rebbe said it ends up with four because the Mayach is plural. Okay, but that's a separate thing. That these bloods are going to be your life, because these two bloods are the replacement for the fact that you don't have mitzvahs. Now I want you to know that this is the foundation of an important legal point. There is a penalty in the Torah for serious crimes called kares. Kares means being cut off from God. That crime applies only to prohibitions, to negative commandments. It doesn't apply to positive commandments, with two exceptions. There are two exceptions. One is bris milah, a person who, according to Rambam anyway, never is circumcised, is punished by kares. The rabbi disagrees. Okay, but anyway, that's it. He makes it worse, more serious. And the Korban Pesach, the Paschal sacrifice. A person who is not involved in the Korban Pesach suffers the penalty of kares. Now, for those who don't know, let's see how good your intuition is. I said he's not involved in the Korban Pesach. Which involvement in the Korban Pesach would be necessary to avoid kares, do you think?
Bringing it.
You see, I have a man here with some experience. It's the slaughtering of it. The eating is not ma'akeh. It's not relevant. It's the slaughtering. If you are involved in the slaughtering, and then, perversely, as the sun goes down, say, I'm not eating it, you're not guilty of kares. You don't get the penalty of kares.
The
mitzvah is the slaughtering and the eating. They are two separate mitzvahs. And for not participating in the slaughtering, the penalty is kares. For not participating in the eating, the penalty is not kares. It's a violation of a commandment. The penalty is not kares. This shows you that when the verse says for the bloods, the list of the bloods, it means the blood daska. It's talking about the blood. It's talking about the sacrifice. And as Chazal say, remember that this animal was a sacred animal to the Egyptians. So the very fact that you took it and killed it was the main importance. You're declaring to the Egyptians what we say in modern English, in your face. Right? Watch! I'm taking the animal 4 days before they took it and tied it to the bedpost. The Egyptians said, what do you want that for? We'll slaughter it. We're going to slaughter it right in front of you. We're not going off into the wilderness like Moses said originally, you know, we'll slaughter it in front of them, won't they stone us? We're going to slaughter it right in front of you. Try to stop us. See if you can do anything. So it's the slaughtering that carries the kares penalty if a person's not involved, not the eating. Yeah.
What's the close connection to the woman? I mean, like, except it's very poetic, but like, why? I mean, you can. They could have somehow shown it another way. Like, why is choose a detail? Like, you know.
The woman is chosen all the time. She is.
Yes, it's a good question and a good answer. And in King Solomon tells us that the right King Solomon before Ezekiel.
Right.
Solomon before Ezekiel.
Right.
Right. King Solomon says the image for the Jewish people is a woman, not a man. Never a man. Good. So if you do it, very good, yeah.
How does that work out with the slaughtering? I mean, every Jewish male has to bring one, or you can just like buy one from like a group of people? I mean, how did that work out? You have 2.5 million Jews, you know.
So from here, the Gemara learns the idea of shlichus, because it says sheshachatu oso kol ha'al es Yisrael. It says the whole of the Jewish community shall slaughter it, and the Gemara says the ki kulam shochtim. It's possible that everybody should slaughter it. He has shluchos shalom kamoso. This is one of the places, the classical place where you learn shlichus. If he does it for me, it's as if I did.
Does that include, like, you know, you have to give them money for it, or they just in general, like?
Well, no. Well, it depends on how it's done. If you go and take your animal and say, this is my Korban Pesach, so then you're related because it's your animal. somebody else wants to become part of it, usually has to buy his way in. Could he get in without buying? I don't know. Maybe if he gave him a gift. But he's getting a right to eat it when it's slaughtered, so it becomes part of the group.
He has to show up.
No, to the slaughtering? No.